Call this meeting of the State Lands Commission to order. All the representatives of the commission are present. I'm Chris Garland, Lieutenant Governor's Chief of Staff. I'm joined today by Deputy Controller and Commissioner Alternate Alan Gordon and Pedro Reyes, representing the Department of Finance. For the benefit of those of you in the audience, the State Lands Commission administers certain property interests owned by the state, including its mineral interests. Today, we will hear proposals concerning the leasing and management of these public property interests. The first item of business will be the adoption of the minutes from the Commission's September 1st meeting. May I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Minutes are unanimously adopted.
Mr. Chair, if I could clarify, today we have two alternates for the constitutional officers, and that's fine. I just want the public to know as well that only two of the commissioners will be able to vote and participate today because of the requirement that at least one constitutional officer be present if all three are to vote. So, is that understanding?
Excellent. Thank you for that. Next order of business, if you'd like to stay on the microphone, is the executive officer's report from Mr. Fossum. May we have your report?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioners, pleased to announce that at the last meeting, while we were still awaiting the final outcome of several bills in the legislature, that at this time we're able to announce not only do they pass through the legislature, but Governor Brown has signed those bills. So we have Senate Bill 152, Pavley, the Fair Rent Bill, Senate Bill 595 from Senator Wolk, dealing with abandoned vessels, Assembly Bill 982, Assemblywoman Skinner, whose solar energy bill will hopefully help us do exchanges with the Bureau of Land Management for alternative energies in the desert, and Assembly Bill 1112 from Assemblyman Huffman, which was able to increase the per barrel tax on or fee on the importation of oil into California, so that actually saved us 16 positions in our oil spill prevention program. So we're pleased to announce that. Governor also signed a number of bills dealing with San Francisco in the Bay Area, dealing with the America's Cup, Hunter's Point, Candlestick, and the Pittsburgh grant. And finally, I'm pleased to announce that we have finally received some applications and the exams in progress to fill our 8-month vacancy of our legislative liaison position, and we have several very interesting and qualified candidates, so I'm pleased to announce that as well. The controllers asked us to take opportunities to educate both the public and the governor's decision makers on the need for additional resources, and this week and the next week we've actually been involved in four different events talking about the audit and the commission's programs. So on Monday we did respond to the Bureau of State Audits and delivered our 60-day response to the Bureau. Tuesday, the Little Hoover Commission had a meeting at which we participated along with the Bureau of State Audits again and General Services, talking about our challenges and opportunities there. Today, of course, we're going to be going over the audit action plan that you requested at our last meeting. And we have, I want to note that we have placed all of these items on our website for the public to be able to share in and review in detail both the audit as well as the responses that have been made. And next Tuesday, the Assembly Budget Subcommittee will be having another presentation by the Bureau of State Audits and the Commission staff in addressing both the audit and the Commission's status in responding to that audit. I'd also like to announce that I'm very pleased to announce, in fact, that the Commission has received a commendation from a proclamation from the City of Goleta for dealing with the hazard removal program. And I'd like to show you that plaque that's been presented by them, and I'll read it. Whereas Elwood Beach and Haskell's Beach were once the site of extensive oil and gas production, and whereas the California State Lands Commission received notice that the governor of California released funds and authorized implementation of the beach hazardous removal program, and whereas the California State Lands Commission sought and obtained all necessary permits and utilized state funds to remove several types of hazardous structures, including piles, sheet piling, H piles, well casings, abandoned pipeline from Elwood Beach and Haskell's Beach, and whereas the California State Lands Commission completed authorized work along the city of Goleta coastline with the intention of returning to the region, including the city of Goleta, to further remove additional beach hazards, now therefore be it resolved on this fourth day of October 2011, that the City Council of the City of Goleta does hereby proclaim its appreciation of the California State Lands Commission and its employees for protecting the environment and citizens of Goleta through implementation of the beach hazards removal project, thus ensuring the health, safety, comfort, and quality of life of Goleta residents and visitors. I would like to say that this is one of several areas along the Santa Barbara Beach where we have had to go in and deal with removal of hazards that were placed on those areas long before the commission ever existed, but do remain on the beach from prior oil operations and other activities there, and so we're very pleased that, that the commission is also recognized in that regard. The next item, I'm also pleased to announce that the commission's staff has been facilitating the Department of Fish and Game's restoration of the ecological reserve at Batiquitos Lagoon. There's 524 acres of public trust lands in that lagoon that we've been involved in restoring for the last few decades. The dredging projects there have stalled, and your staff and its expertise in pushing through contracts, it was agreed by all the players that that we should be doing that. And so next month they'll begin that dredging project. They're going to remove 118,000 cubic yards of beach quality sand and put on the adjacent beaches there. We also want to acknowledge that the funding for this project came from the Port of Los Angeles and their mitigation for some of port projects years ago. And finally, this is one of the highlights of California's response to trying to create new habitat for the California least tern and western snowy plover, and it's been very successful in that regard, so we're pleased to announce that. I also want to acknowledge that on item 24 on the consent agenda is the Salt River Restoration. This is one of the largest tidal and wetlands restoration projects in the northern part of California that's ever been attempted. And I also want to acknowledge that Donna Chambers is here today from the Humboldt County Resource Conservation District, and she's heading up that effort. Next year will be the next phase of that, and I think we'll try and present a presentation to the commission at that time. On another note that I think is important for our economic and energy, clean energy efforts, the geysers in Northern California, Calpine, has just announced that they're spending $700 million in expanding the geysers. It's already the largest geothermal operation in the world, producing 725 megawatts of clean energy that is enough to power the electrical needs of San Francisco. Unlike other alternative energy projects, this operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the first new power plant, and there's going to be two of them, that have been built at the geysers in 22 years, so we're really excited about that. It's going to provide almost another 100 megawatts and 190 jobs, construction jobs, and it's using 100% reclaimed water. It hopes to generate $7 million in annual property taxes, $12 million in sales taxes, and $17 million in expenses for operations annually to the local economy there. It also will reduce about between 139,000 and 199,000 tons of CO2 per year, while paying $1 million in federal royalty, $1.5 million in private royalties, and, most importantly, $1.5 million in state royalties to the commission for the benefit of STIRS. It's up for its final vote on November 8th before the Sonoma County Board of Supervisors, so we're hopeful that that goes forward. And finally, we have some good news and some bad news. First, the good. I'm pleased to announce that we were able to convince Don Hermanson to come out of retirement to head the Commission's Marine Facilities Division. Don previously spent 15 years in the Coast Guard, 17 years with the Commission before retiring last year, and we had a number of excellent candidates for that position, and Don was agreeable to come back out of retirement to serve us in that role, and I'd like to introduce Don at this time. You can stand up. And my final statement is the bad news, and that is that for the commission is that's Greg Stott, our chief of the Mineral Management Division, help me out here, has announced that he will be retiring in January, and I'm not going to go into it any further because we'll be giving him a proper bon voyage at our next meeting. And with that ends my executive officer's report. I will add that we have removed three items from the agenda. Those are C-16, C-21, and C-31, and we'll be removing from the consent agenda C-35 and putting it on the regular agenda. We have a number of people who wish to speak on that, and so we'll provide that during the regular agenda portion.
I believe we discussed pulling C-36 as well, since we had a speaker.
Yes, that's correct. Oh, I'm sorry. That's only if it's taken off the consent agenda. They're prepared to respond to any questions, basically. So it's just 35 at this time.
Good. Then we are pulling just C-35.
Correct.
All right, the next item on the agenda is the consent calendar. Does anyone in the audience wish to speak to the consent calendar?
So move the calendar.
Calendar's moved. Do I hear a second?
I'll second. I do have a question on C-10, though.
I'll turn your mic on.
There we
yes.
go. Yes. I do have a question on C-10. Clearly the...
Yes, this was a, if I could introduce that, this item, this was an item that comes up regularly for the commission as a rent review. Every 5 years, many of our leases are available for the commission to make decisions on either raising rent, lowering rent, or maintaining it at the same level. The applicant in this regard had asked to have his minimum rents reduced, not the formula for percentage rents, but his minimum rents, because he had suffered less than minimum rent in his percentages for two of the last 3 years. Typically, we would look at if it was consistently over 3 years or over 5 years and it didn't qualify. However, we're also looking at raising his bond and insurance levels, and so we did recommend to the commission, and that is on the consent, that we would lower his minimum by $1,000. I think he sought a $5,000 minimum rent. He's actually out of the country. We encouraged him to send a representative. He also has the opportunity to actually apply to the commission, obviously, mm-hmm. to change his contract if he so desires. This was the commission staff's opportunity to bring to the commission its recommendation. And if we don't do it at this time, if it's pulled from the agenda, then basically we have to wait a year to bring this kind of issue back to the commission, or he would have to apply, and that would typically cost him money to go through the application process. So, and he can still do that regardless of what the commission does at this meeting.
For my own edification, how long is the process of conversations between you and the applicant to this point?
If I could, I'd like to have Mary Hayes of our Land Management Division speak to that, because she's been directly involved in it, and it has been, I believe, at least a year, but I'll let her answer that question.
Thank you.
We first notified the lessee in the fall of 2010 was our first contact with him, and actually we had calculated rent as of that date, which would have raised his rent, because we were looking at the past five mm-hmm. years. So we gave him the opportunity to wait a year to see, in fact, if he had had a third year of a downturn. And his minimum for that third year was actually above his minimum. So so we gave at least a year, and so at the same time, he was still asking to lower his rent.
Okay. Thank you. I'm good.
And just to be clear, this does not preclude him from correct. Requesting another review at his expense.
That's correct.
Thank you. Right? I'm satisfied. Thank you.
Any other questions or folks who'd like to speak on? We had a motion.
And a second.
And a second. All those in favor?
Two out of three. Aye.
All those opposed? Consent calendar is adopted. We are going to move now on to the polled item, which would be C-35, if you're keeping score. May we have the staff's presentation on that item?
Yes, Chair. Speaking on that item will be Michelle Anderson, our one granted lands representative for the state of California.
If I might just give it a second for the room to clear. Apparently, we had a bunch of folks here for the consent calendar who are now clearing the room. Thank you for coming. Have a good day.
They get an early lunch.
All right. We appear to be calmed down now and the room cleared. Thank you.
Good morning, members of the commission. My name is Michelle Anderson. I'm the Granted Lands Representative for the Land Management Division. On July 15th of 2011, staff received an application from the San Diego Unified Port District for the construction of a pile-supported concrete mooring dolphin and a catwalk at the end of the B Street Pier within the San Diego Bay. As proposed, the mooring structure would extend 170 feet into the bay onto ungranted sovereign land. The existing pier is located within lands that have been legislatively granted to the San Diego Unified Port District. The project site currently operates as a cruise ship terminal and often accommodates cruise liners that extend beyond the existing 1,000-foot pier. As proposed, this project will allow the mooring lines of longer ships that extend beyond the west end of the pier to be safely secured to two mooring ballards on the proposed dolphin. Staff is recommending authorization of a 49-year general lease public agency use for the construction of the concrete mooring dolphin and catwalk. Irene McCormick, Vice President of External Relations, Mark Taylor, Marine Terminal Superintendent, and James Hirsch, Land Use Planning Manager with the Port District, are here today to answer any questions.
Thank you for your presentation. Thank you for your presentation. Comments from the commissioners on this item? Excellent. Moving on to public comments.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, yes. Apparently we don't have our 3-minute timer today, and so my secretary Kim Linetta will give you a signal when their time has expired, and you'll be able to then make your judgment on that.
Excellent. Or we can set an iPhone if somebody has one. We're just going to go in order in which they came in. So I've got a Corey Briggs. I'd like to step to the microphone, and while we don't have our 3-minute timer, I'd ask you to use your internal clock, if you would. Nope. He's here. He's running around the back. And down the stretch he comes. And we will not take this away from your time. Thank you, Peter.
Can I get a little bit of time to recover from
running? Catch your breath and then start when
Thanks.
You're ready.
Commissioners, thank you for the or alternates. Thank you for the opportunity this morning. I'm Corey Briggs. I'm here on behalf of the San Diego Navy Broadway Complex Coalition. We encourage you not to approve this lease today until there's been full compliance with CEQA. Playing before you is a video of B Street Pier as it is now. This is the traffic and congestion we get with the current cruise ships. You're being told that the mooring dolphins and catwalk are for safety. Not true. I submitted a letter this morning. The original with the DVD that's playing along with all the exhibits was submitted. You should have the copies. I also gave 3 copies. That includes excerpts of the documents I'm talking about this morning. The port is not playing straight with the commission. The commission has received the port's application, and it says that the purpose is to increase the size of cruise ships and increase the number of passengers coming to the terminal. On the video is what we live with now. There will be increased environmental impacts. You've got to do a CEQA analysis. My letter details all of the impacts. One thing you should know is that the Coastal Commission a couple of years ago approved a 150-foot mooring dolphin and catwalk for BAE Systems, which also came before the commission. The Coastal Commission imposed conditions of approval because they needed to mitigate potentially significant environmental impacts due to shading that affected foraging birds. They didn't have to impose any conditions because of the loss of public access, because BAE's pier was already off limits to the public. B Street is not off limits to the public. People on the bay can currently sail up to the pier when there's no cruise ship there. You're now going to take 170 feet away. On top of that, we have federal security regulations that require a 300-foot security zone around any docked cruise ship. If these ships are longer, the security zone gets bigger and more of our bay is blocked off. None of these impacts have been analyzed under CEQA. What's more troubling is that the port took this to the Coastal Commission and got a coastal development permit waiver based on a CEQA exemption that the port gave itself This is Exhibit E in the packet that I gave you. And at the bottom of page one, the top of page two, here's what they said. And you can see it's stamped, received by the Coastal Commission. No substantial public impacts to the public would be anticipated. The project would not attract more people to the area or enable additional people to use the area. Based on that lie, the executive director of the Coastal Commission unwittingly approved a waiver of the coastal development permit. The public was not informed of any of this until after the fact, until it was a fait accompli. It wasn't even listed on the commission's agenda other than as a deputy director's report. But I show you the agenda in your exhibits as well, and you can see there isn't even a link to any documents. So nobody following the Coastal Commission would know that the port has gone there.
Let me stop you there for sure. One second. The upside to your presentation is it's an excellent presentation. The downside is there's actually a running timer on your video.
And I'm close to 3 minutes.
You went up for about 3.5 minutes.
Okay, so let me just wrap it up and tell you that if you approve this today, you're basically putting the imprimatur on a process that excluded the public. My client has been involved with the port for years trying to work on the redesign of the waterfront. They're currently redesigning what's known as phase two of the North Embarcadero plan, which is where the cruise ships are. They're doing the redesign, and now they're here expanding the terminal with no public input before the Coastal Commission based on an exemption. If you approve this today, at least get an indemnity provision in your lease, because we'll sue under CEQA. This is not acceptable until there's full environmental review. But don't let this agency have to pay for it.
Thank you. Next up is Michael Warburton.
I'm running on this one. I've appeared before as executive director of the Public Trust Alliance, which acts to protect public rights in sovereign lands and resources. I'm here today as a Californian and mostly as a parent of a 13-year-old girl who I want to explain why things happen the way they do. She's a beneficiary of the public trust. Usually when you have a trustee making an application for either a lease or construction, the public benefits are so clear and that they outweigh the public costs. Planning's been going on for San Diego Harbor for a long time. In 1908, the Nolan Plan, city plan, said that industrial and maritime uses would be concentrated south of Broadway, cultural and public access, recreational activities would be concentrated north. There's cruise ship lines are very, very much they're not a maritime use. They're basically floating hotels. And I think the commission has they're huge. They're walls. Blocking views, blocking access with the new security zones. They actually impede people's being able to use the waterfront for views or for recreation. And what's happening is you have a lull in the cruise ship industry because of the violence in Mexico, so that far, far fewer boats are actually coming to San Diego. And you have a study going on that maybe the 10th Avenue Marine Terminal is a better place to have cruise ships, which will block public access. So in its present form, what you have is a gift to a moribund industry and at tremendous public sacrifice in terms of parks and mitigation. All of this has been done through exemptions and de minimis declarations, and yet it's a just a qualitative change of what the whole waterfront will be. The Port of San Diego dissolved its Citizens Advisory Committee when they seemed to be getting, dissenting views. The League of Women Voters made a very, very articulate plea for good government. And the approval of this under exemption is totally inappropriate. The city of San Diego is already the only modern metropolis discharging phenomenal amounts of sewage under a waiver from the Clean Water Act. Everything is done under waiver, and it's done at great public cost, and the State Lands Commission should be acting to protect public rights and public property, which is being given away in this situation.
Thank you for your presentation.
Do we have a representative from the Coastal Commission here by any chance? I will tell you at this point in time, and I'm very concerned about the process that went on at the Coastal Commission, and would like someone, maybe if state land staff is familiar with what that was. We have a fairly serious allegation that this waiver was granted without public knowledge or opportunity to comment at the commission, and I'm very strongly leaning towards abstaining on the vote at this point in time until I learn a little bit more from the Coastal Commission or about the process that went on there.
Anybody in the room?
I don't believe we have anybody from the Coastal Commission, but we do have representatives from the port and also our Planning and Environmental Management Division when on the CEQA issue and, the action that the Coastal Commission took. But, the allegations against the Coastal Commission, if they fail to comply with the Coastal Act, for example, then there are remedies there as well.
All right, as we try and maybe figure this one out, ask our next speaker to come to the podium. Excuse me if I get this wrong. Irene McCormick? Is that correct?
Yes, sir, that is.
Thank you.
If you would like us to answer the question about the Coastal Commission and how we prepared our coastal development permit for the Coastal Commission, and then they asked us just to go for a waiver, I have our expert here from the Port of San Diego who worked on that particular issue. If not, that's
not
fine.
Going to satisfy my answer. As advocates for the port, I understand
yes.
Your position fairly well, and I just want to make it really clear. No one should ascertain that substantively I'm making a decision as to how I will vote ultimately. What this is about for me is process.
Correct.
And following the proper notice requirements, giving the public an opportunity to testify at the commission. Mm-hmm. And if that did not occur, if that wasn't noticed, my inclination would be, and I would also like to ask a question to state lands and the port. Let me then ask and follow with this question would be, if we were to put this decision off until our next meeting when we would have someone from the Coastal Commission here to testify, what negative impact would that have on the port's plans?
Okay. If I might start, and then I can also answer that question as I'm speaking, sir, that would be great. Hi, I'm Irene McCormick. Whoops. I'm a Vice President of External Relations at the Port of San Diego, and thank you very much for hearing this today. This is an operational issue for the Port of San Diego. We did a lot of work on CEQA, and the length of the pier needs to be lengthened because of the length of the cruise ships in port. We don't accept any ships at our port right now over 1,000 feet because we don't have the capacity. And even if we did accept a cruise port, we would never have more than 6,000 passengers on that pier at any given time, no matter what. The acreage of the pier does not allow us to have anything more. Just so you know, the port has been in the business of the cruise industry since the 70s. It is in an ebb right now. Cruise, because of the situation in Mexico along the West Coast, has declined. But we do expect it to get bigger as we go along, to increase. But that's all, you know, that has a lot to do with the condition in Mexico. Really, there's only places we can go there. We also, we have a lot of jobs that come from the cruise operations there. The longshoremen have about 200 longshore workers who work there and are very interested in this and have sent a letter to the commission just to let you know their support for us as well. For us, this is an operational safety issue. We need this mooring dolphin in order to tie up cruise ships. If we don't, a tidal surge, a tsunami, any kind of storm when a port is when a ship is berthed at that pier could affect the workers who work there. It could become unsafe. So that's why we pursued this to begin with. We weren't doing it to increase operations over above what our capacity are on that pier. We could never have any, like I said, if there are two cruise ships in ports, the number of passengers has to be less than 6,000, 6,000 or less. So we're not going to get mega ships there. We're just going to try to keep this issue to an operational issue. We did apply to the California Coastal Commission for a coastal development permit. The Coastal Commission staff suggested that based on the work we did of CEQA and our capacity issues at the pier, that it be a waiver. And they granted us a waiver instead of going through the coastal development permit as we had asked. So for us, it is a safety issue. It's an operational must for our cruise industry. Whether or not the cruise ships stay there for, you know, 20 years or 30 years, moving a cruise ship operation to any other place in the bay will take a long process to plan it, look at it, and see if it's worthwhile for San Diego. If you have any questions, I'm welcome to answer them for you at any time.
I believe there was one outstanding question from...
So am I to understand that you did not request the waiver, that the Coastal Commission granted it on their own behalf?
Yes. We went and we filed a coastal development permit and they said it was a waiver.
That's not true. And there was one other question I asked earlier about what the ramifications of a delay would be if this were not taken up today.
You know, if we could take it up within the next month, I think we'd be okay. We're looking to get this mooring dolphin in place for our cruise season that starts in 2013, not any time sooner. So September 2013 is when we'd like to get it in place. I think a month delay would not be an issue for us right now. We do have other permits we have to work through with the Army Corps of Engineer and several others, and we have to design it as well. So that's what we're looking at.
Let me ask, there's one thing about your testimony that's maybe I'm just being dense here. So you're claiming this is your testimony is that this is about safety for the workers and for the environment. You've got an existing capacity for 6,000. My understanding of the cruise ship industry is they are supersizing these boats, that they're getting bigger. So what you're telling us is that you have an existing capacity for 6,000 people at one time. I'm guessing today that means maybe two smaller ships, and what you're trying to do is design this so you can take one of the larger floating hotels.
Yes, but it probably... we usually have the smaller ships in San Diego, but we don't know what the capacity, you know, what the cruise lines are going to be building. If you look at what cruise lines are building now, they're building, you know, 1,200-foot ships that have a capacity for 5,000 passengers on it. So if a ship like that were to dock in San Diego, we could only handle one ship at a time. We would never put two ships there, so we'd never have more than 6,000 passengers on that particular pier because the acreage of the pier can't handle it. The operations of the pier couldn't handle putting stores on that ship or taking the bags off the ship when you have, you know, more than 6,000 passengers. But that isn't typically nowadays and within the next 5 years what the Port of San Diego does. Ships that big usually go to Long Beach or Los Angeles because of the... ability that they have up there and the longer pier they have up there right now. Some of the ships, the new ships that the cruise lines are building, even though they still have the same number of passengers, like 2,600, maybe 3,000, but they're building them because of the amenities on the ship. They're building them longer and a little bit higher because of what the tourists want on the ship. So it's not necessarily getting bigger in passenger size, but it's getting bigger in the amenities that are on the ship for people to enjoy.
Thank you. Thank you for taking our questions as well.
Thank you.
We have one final speaker on this agenda item. It's Jim Hirsch. Jim, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. I just want to make a few comments here. Number one, I do have a copy of the coastal development permit that was filed with the Coastal Commission with me here today. I can certainly make that a part of the record. And it was their own determination to grant the waiver, not our request. With respect to CEQA, we did issue the categorical exemption and based it on the fact that there was a capacity threshold of 6,000 people on the pier. So the feeling was we were not exacerbating or aggravating that as long as we were able to stay below that. With respect to the public process, one of my functions at the port for the past 6 months has been as the project manager of the North Embarcadero Port Master Plan Amendment, and within that area is the B Street Pier, and it's certainly been a focus of discussion. And what I am reading in the letters that you received is that the individuals, two of whom indicated, and they were members of the Citizens Advisory Committee, that they were totally in the dark. They had no idea this was going on. And further, that there had been no discussion. I actually have the minutes of the meeting of July 8th, which was our eighth meeting, with me. I can certainly make that a part of the record. There are minutes taken by two different sources. And in those minutes, it's clear that there was a discussion, a brief discussion, albeit, but nevertheless, it was bandied about that there was a mooring dolphin that had been approved by the Coastal Commission a month before June 15th, so this is now July 20th, and one of the writers to you, Ms. Diane Coombs, who indicated she was totally in the dark, actually suggested at that meeting that perhaps, given that the Broadway Pier, which has been certainly a subject of controversy, since that pavilion and pier is now operational, that we make lemons out of lemonade, as she put it, and say that that is our primary pier from now on, and why don't we move this mooring dolphin to that location? So I really can't understand for the life of me how someone can say they had no idea about it when they were, in fact, suggesting that perhaps we put it in an alternate location. Clearly she knew about it. Clearly it was a subject of discussion. So that concludes my response, unless you have any further questions.
Questions from the commissioners? Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Can I please have 30 seconds? Just 30 seconds.
We have a process, and you've already spoken once to do an extended time hearing.
You
so
straight.
I'm going to ask you
Just keep in mind that the July 8th meeting was after the June Coastal Commission meeting when this happened. It was disclosed after the
Thank you. Thank you.
Curtis, when is our December meeting? I know we've moved it around all over the place. When is our next meeting scheduled for at this point?
Still is a rolling date.
Yeah, it's a rolling date.
It's posted as being December 22nd on our website. That's when the commission chose earlier in the year to set that date. But it's my understanding that we won't have a quorum for that date, so we're searching to find alternative dates, either earlier in December or in the early part of January.
This is my inclination at this point in time, speaking only for myself and frankly having not had an opportunity to discuss this with the controller yet. I think the allegations over what the Coastal Commission did or didn't do are significant. I'm not looking to give the opponents of this project two bites at the apple, meaning Coastal Commission and State Lands Commission, and looking to avoid litigation. So my inclination at this point in time is to abstain if there's a vote, but I would make a motion to put this decision over until our next meeting, as the port has testified that there would not be negative impacts to them, put this over until our December meeting, have an opportunity to talk with the Coastal Commission in the meantime, bring them in if necessary, if we're not satisfied, to put them on the record as to what happened at their July meeting and vote after hearing from the Coastal Commission.
Well, the motion would take precedence, so we've got a motion from the controller's representative. Does it have a second?
I guess as I'm listening to the debate and the issues being brought forth, as long as this does not have an impact on the development, if it were to move forward, if this has a negative impact or limits the ability to for the port to move forward, that causes me concern, because I'm ready to support the staff's recommendation right now. I think that the expansion of the pier by an additional 57 yards, 56 and a half yards out, while it does impact the waterways and so forth, fact of the matter is ships are getting bigger, therefore a bit more amenities, not necessarily for more people. The very big ships actually end up going to cargo areas in some cases, which in my opinion also creates other health issues, problem issues, in terms of safety of the passengers, because they're now dealing with forklifts and trucks. And the picture that I saw is not uncommon on any of the ports I've ever been to where I've taken a cruise ship. Tampa, Puerto Rico, you name it, it's that same issue comes up. The day of departure and arrival, you got twice the volume of the ship being processed at the same time, within a short period of time anyway. But as I'm looking at the folks in the back, and if this is extended for another month, a month and a half, it has no detrimental impact on the project. And I'm hearing the yes. So I will second the motion then to postpone if staff also tells me that's not create an issue.
We've been informed by the port as well that they don't believe a one-meeting delay will significantly interfere with the project.
Okay, then in that case, I will second the motion for the delay.
All right, we have a motion and a second to pull this item and table it until the next meeting of the commission. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Item is put over until the December meeting of the commission. Thank you to both sides for your presentation and for being here today. We appreciate it very much. Moving on now to, we haven't pulled 36, so that's not happening. We're now on to the regular items, and that begins with item number 54. The commission staff's audit action plan. And while the room clears again, we'll take a brief second here to let the commotion die down and then ask the staff to make its presentation. Whenever you're ready. Thank you.
Let me just say that this informational item to the commission in response to its last request is one that we've put a lot of time and effort into, and Dave Brown, who is our chief of the administrative staff, will present this, and additional staff are available to answer any questions the commission may have.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Chairman and commissioners. My name is Dave Brown, and I am the chief of the Administrative Services Division of the State Lands Commission, and will be presenting staff's audit action plan in response to the Bureau of State Audit's report 210-125. The Commission directed staff at its September 1st meeting to prepare a plan to address the findings by the Bureau regarding the Commission's management of leases of state property. Their report describes areas where auditors noted a failure of staff to perform certain duties or to pursue certain debts or lessees. Staff has reviewed the findings and, as reported previously, found most to be reasonably accurate, if not somewhat sensationalized and without perspective of the Commission's overall responsibilities and accomplishments. Many of the findings revealed process breakdowns or an inability to maintain certain responsibilities due to staffing limitations. As I reported to the Commission back in February of this year, the Commission's general fund supported positions have been eroding for the past 20 years. In 1990, the commission had 242 positions supported by the general fund. The current budget has only 62. This is a 74% reduction over that period. These core general fund positions are those that perform lease compliance and trespass enforcements, appraisals and rent reviews, oil and gas reservoir analysis and production engineering, royalty accounting and financial auditing, hazard removal, and litigation support. They are also responsible for much of the Granted Lands Trust Management Program. All activities that are vital to the effective management of the public trust assets entrusted to the Commission's care, and, not coincidentally, those for which the Commission is now being criticized for not performing effectively. Nonetheless, over the same period, through careful prioritization of activities to maintain its income stream, the Commission has continued to earn revenues of over $3.8 billion. In spite of this record of generating substantial non-tax revenue income, the Commission has never been considered a revenue-producing agency for the purpose of being exempted from across-the-board budget cuts. As I also noted in February, the general fund portion of the Commission's budget has been suffering from death by a thousand cuts, none alone that would be fatal, but over time have been debilitative to many of the general fund activities. The Commission has received additional positions from other funding sources for new regulatory programs regarding oil spill prevention and marine invasive species programs, and has also relied much more heavily on reimbursements from project applicants to cover staffing. Commission staff still numbers just over 200, but because of limitations dictated by funding sources, these other positions must be devoted only to those programs and are not available to address the issues pointed out in the Bureau's report. The little blue portion there is the general fund. The other colors are other funding sources that must be devoted to those program activities. The Bureau acknowledged this staffing issue in Chapter 3 of the report, and I quote, "Significant reductions in staff have hindered the Commission's ability to conduct activities necessary to ensure that the state receives appropriate revenues and that lessees comply with lease terms. Repeated requests to prior administrations for staffing have gone unheeded. Several past budget requests have been submitted directly addressing those deficiencies that have now been identified in the Bureau's audit findings. The Commission staff also identified this loss of staffing as a major risk in its 2009 biennial Financial Integrity and State Managers Accountability Act, or FISMA, report in regards to both erosion of the general fund positions and the depletion of staff in the audit program. The Bureau's report makes several recommendations for correcting deficiencies noted and improving processes and procedures. However, such procedural and process improvement recommendations can only impact the deficiencies noted to the extent that adequate staff resources are available to implement and carry out the work. The simple fact is that a program cannot sustain staff reductions on a scale experienced by the Commission with the expectation that there will be no adverse impact on activities to carry out those program responsibilities. As such, as a first priority in response to the audit, staff has prepared and forwarded requests for additional staffing for consideration. These requests reflect the most urgent needs to address the areas of auditing and royalty accounting, lease compliance and revenue enhancement, to perform reviews, pursue delinquent and non-compliant leases, and prosecute trespassers, and Tidelands Trust compliance for oversight of the 85 grants to local governments. These requests represent the most urgent staffing needs necessary to immediately address those areas deficient in resources to sustain effective program levels. Staff also recognizes the need to effectively quantify its overall staffing needs and will continue to analyze workload and program outputs as a result and results as suggested in the report in preparing future requests. I'd now like to outline the efforts of staff regarding the recommendations made by the Bureau. The report identified six major areas of concern. These include delinquent leases and general lease compliance, holdovers, missed rent reviews, audit cycles for leases, statutory trust grant oversight, and the lease database. Regarding lease compliance, for delinquent leases, a comprehensive review of accounts receivable is being conducted. While the commission's records show an amount well below that asserted by the Bureau in their report, there are several leases that have been in arrears for a number of years. Each is being examined for other compliance issues and in addition to non-payment, and will be addressed until resolved, subject to availability of staff. For future delinquent or non-compliant leases, a procedure is under development to address coordination between divisions. A management group, including division chiefs and the chief counsel, will meet no less than quarterly to prioritize those leases failing compliance for additional action steps, up to and including litigation. This procedure is expected to be in place November 1st. Staff is also pursuing other remedies, including participation in the state intercept program, as well as collection agencies. For general compliance issues, staff is investigating options such as penalties for failure to comply with insurance and bonding requirements, or possible punitive measures for unauthorized structures or activities on the leasehold. Holdovers. As noted in the Bureau's report, procedures to reduce the number of leases in holdover were directed to Commission staff in November of 2010. In March 2011, staff finalized the language for holdover notification letters for both significant and routine leases as laid out in the holdover reduction procedure. Finalized language and formalized practice, including a two-year lease renewal notification in the leases, and finalized holdover checklist, which identifies the steps for timeframes, have been issued to staff. LMD management also continues to hold monthly meetings to discuss the status of holdovers and those leases assigned to contingent receivables. As of today, 24 of the 32 leases that were in holdover have been resolved, with only 8 remaining, with a value of over $10,000 a year each, or in total. Of those remaining, one, GP Gypsum, was on today's agenda. One involves a toxic site that will remain in holdover until remediation is complete. One is a non-operational caretaker status, and three are scheduled for the commission action in the first half of 2012. The remaining two will be renewed upon completion of environmental documentation, but have already had the rent updated and their payments are current. Rent reviews. Commission staff has continued to develop and refine its rent review process. In late 2010, leases due for rent review began being pulled once or 1 year in advance, as opposed to 9 months. In April 2011, the rent review checklist, which identifies steps and timeframes for staff to adhere to, was updated, and these changes have been effective in helping staff complete rent reviews in a timely fashion. Staff continues to also move forward with expanded use of the Consumer Price Index in applying automatic annual rent revisions. Staff will be recommending to the Commission the expanded use of CPI in the most high-value commercial use, industrial use, and right-of-way use leases, and is also exploring the use of CPI in lower-value leases to assist in streamlining the review process. Staff has also updated and consolidated the San Francisco and Marin County benchmarks and is progressing on scheduled periodic updates of benchmarks throughout the state. Audit cycles for leases. Over the past several years, due to significant reduction in auditor positions, staff has not been able to implement an audit schedule or plan. Instead, most of the staff's efforts have been focused on auditing leases with identified problems in royalty payments, or in response to assignments or other changes requested by lessees. As a result of the Bureau's report, Commission staff has developed a proposed audit schedule. This audit schedule places oil and gas, mineral, and geothermal dredging leases on a rotating audit schedule based on the following criteria: mandated through regulation, revenue generated from the lease, the amount of revenue, date of findings of the last audit, applicable statutes of limitation, identified issues in royalty payments, lease assignments, notification by lessee of pending changes, and then lastly, commercial and surface leases. As you can see on the slide here, as a result, this go-forward plan, this slide contrasts what will be possible with existing staff versus those if additional staff is made available. Without new staffing, it is likely that the program will continue to be reactive based on identified problems. Oversight of statutory grants, trust grants. The Bureau's report stated, and I quote, "The Commission should establish a monitoring program to ensure that the funds generated from granted lands are expended in accordance with the public trust." Staff agrees with the report's recommendation. However, there is currently only one staff position dedicated to overseeing the management of these lands by approximately 85 local government trustees pursuant to over 300 statutes. Commission staff has had to take a reactive approach to carrying out its responsibilities by responding to allegations of improper use of lands and funds rather than proactively identifying and preventing misuse through periodic monitoring. Even in this reactive environment, Commission staff is unable to investigate all allegations. As described previously, staff has submitted a request to restore the program, which will include implementing a monitoring program and developing and maintaining a close relationship with trustees. Lease database. Action has been taken to improve the accuracy and reliability of the data in the ALID system. Staff has been instructed to complete entry of all commission actions into the system within 30 days of meetings and with a follow-up to ensure that they're there by 60 days. All income-producing leases have been verified for data elements relating to rent amounts, rent review dates, lease term, lease expiration dates, and so on. Non-income leases will be verified upon availability of staff to do so. A programmer has been assigned to work with LMD management to develop management reports and ad hoc reporting capability that will allow ready access to data in a form and format that will be useful in decision making. In addition to this, excuse me, investigations have begun into the availability of off-the-shelf lease asset management software packages, either commercially available or from other governmental agencies, as suggested in the report, that could be provide a more extensive and flexible reporting capabilities. Particularly intriguing right now are cloud solutions. There's some software as a service offerings out there that would require minimal development time and tremendous flexibility and are currently being used in educational institutions and some local governments. Such software as a service systems provide web access and may provide public transparency as well as operational effectiveness. Legislative and regulation change.
I apologize.
Yes, sir.
Apologize for the interruption. You talked about software that other state agencies would use. What other state agencies would be in our position?
Department of General Services. That was one of the suggestions that the Bureau.
No, I noticed that, but I think they're kind of at the other end. You know, they're kind of, they're,
I would agree with you. However,
they're kind of the tenants, not the landlords. Yeah, I'm just kind of an observation. I mean, I can see like forestry or so. I don't know. I'm just trying to think.
I kind of chuckled at that.
I laughed, but okay. That's why I want to bring it up.
We are. Thank you. We're also approaching the Bureau of Land Management that does have more similar activities than us as well.
As well, but they have far fewer. I think they only have like 300 leases. And we're upward around 4,000. So,
thank you.
Legislation and regulation changes. Commission staff is also currently exploring and analyzing potential legislative and regulation changes as appropriate to give Commission and its staff ample authority to implement some of the activities proposed above. One is to update the Commission's regulations, Title II of the California Code of Regulations, regarding rents. We also are going to be looking into imposition of a lease management fee for surface leases. We do need, one of the suggestions by the auditor was participation in the state intercept program. However, in order to do so, we need to collect Social Security numbers. We currently have a legal opinion back from the 80s that says we don't have that kind of authority. And we're, council's looking at that again, and we may need to get some legislation. Yes, sir.
What is the state intercept program?
That is over at Franchise Tax Board, that you provide a Social Security number, and they will intercept any tax refunds, lottery winnings, everything else.
Oh, okay.
It's any refund coming back from the state, and they're trying to expand it as well. So any money going back to the public from the state, other state agencies are canvassed to see if that individual owes any money. The Child Support Services is one of the big users. Okay. And the use of private collection agencies. I learned something today.
Actually, we're also going to expand it to some of the financing authorities where the state money is involved, and part of the agreement would be that the entities that are dependent on state resources, we would provide that as one of the options for payment.
Okay.
And also, we may need some legislation for the use of private collection agencies. In our discussions with, we have spoken to Franchise Tax on that, and one of the things they cautioned us on is to make sure we had the authority to be able to turn that kind of private information over to the collection agency. They have a specific statute to do so, and we're investigating what we would need to do the same. We're also looking into penalties for failure to secure required insurance or to meet other lease conditions. This is kind of a complicated one. I don't know where that will go, but administrative remedies for trespass actions. In conclusion, even in the face of these continual staff reductions as described throughout the action plan, Commission staff has continued to seek opportunities to generate revenue for the state for the private or commercial use of state property. For example, this past legislative session was very successful given staff's resources. Three bills, two of which were sponsored by the Commission and the other supported by Commission. One was SB 152, which will bring all of the recreational piers into revenue-producing status, with which there are about 1,000 of those. AB 595 by Wolk on abandoned vessels, which reduces the pain that we have to go through to remove an abandoned vessel. And then AB 982, which was by Skinner as a renewable energy program out in the negotiating with BLM that Curtis mentioned earlier. These bills together will assist the Commission in generating additional revenue to the state while also assisting the Commission in cleaning up the state's waterway and streamlining the process for removing abandoned vessels. As expressed in response to the Bureau's report, Commission staff does appreciate the recommendations detailed by the Bureau, and most of the recommendations are practical and achievable, and if the Commission is provided with sufficient resources to retain some staff, we feel we can get it done. Thank you. That's the end of my presentation.
One thing I would like to add on that is that, as I mentioned earlier, our website does have these documents, and in particular, the state auditor requested that we provide documentation of the efforts the Commission had already put together to remedy the shortcomings that they had identified. And so in the 60-day response that we provided them on Monday, we provided 16 sets of documents to them, 11 of which are available for public review. They're on our website, posted prominently on the front page. And access to that. Five of them, however, were confidential and remain not available for public review, but we provided all that documentation. We think it's very important to show the processes that Dave mentioned that will expedite our ability to keep on top of these issues and not let them miss deadlines and so forth. So,
thank you. Any questions or comments from the Commission?
I have two issues that I don't say concern me, but I'm interested in, and I didn't see addressed. One is the insurance requirements. And when I first started 6 months ago-ish, I looked at this and said there didn't seem to be any standardized rules for determining what insurance would be required and what would happen if it weren't provided. And I would put the exact same question with regard to bonding requirements, how we make those determinations. And I didn't see in this any established procedure for making those determinations.
And that's correct. It wasn't brought out specifically in any real fashion by the audit, but it is a problem. And we do look on a case-by-case basis at each individual facility that would occupy state property. One of the things we did talk to Department of General Services and had a meeting with their experts on insurance, and they provided us some insight on that. One of the things we had been hearing from many tenants is the requirement the commission has put into its leases that if the insurance certificate is going to expire, that we get 30 days notice at a minimum. I think it's 30 or 60. And the industry has stopped being willing to do that. It's paperwork for them or something. And so it's a dilemma for our lessees to be able to do it, but it seems like it's really kind of a passing the buck thing that the insurance company has done by its unwillingness to say that it's canceling the insurance and providing the covered insureds such as the state notice of that so that we can follow up on it. So it's a bit of a dilemma there. We are struggling with how to put that back on the our lessee, mm-hmm. but it's something that came out in our discussions with the Department of General Services in that. And what we have looked at is the minimums and in the past, and we look at what's going on in the real world out there as far as the kind of insurance coverage that's being maintained, whether it's a individual with a recreational pier or whether it's a marina in an operation like that, and certainly with the oil companies operating either marine terminals or operations. I'm very happy to say a couple of the things that Dave touched on. This assignment, the assignments that you proved earlier today, dealing with ERA's assignment to Occidental Petroleum of the leases down in Southern California, we've raised the bond amounts there, and the insurance went from $250,000, I believe, to, $30 million from two. So we look very carefully at that. We know that those kind of operations are have a significant potential for liability, and so we want as much coverage as possible. On top of the insurance, we have indemnity and hold harmless provisions so that if there is any types of liability that's assigned in a lawsuit, that not only have we got the insurance to go for first, but the backup is the company's assets. So bonding is probably even more problematic to some degree, because even though we can get significant bonds by some of the major industrial users and commercial users, if we start looking at some of the smaller users of state property, bonds become almost prohibitive for them, and it's a real dilemma for us. The bonds have historically have been fairly low, and the commission is using a bond. For example, one of the criticisms we had on the lease at in the Carquinez area, we are collecting a bond for some of the past rent there, but to be able to remove facilities that have been in place and the value and the costs of removal of facilities if somebody abandons them, it's very difficult for us to get a bond that's high enough to accommodate that. And so there are some real policy questions about even an operation that's doing a good job, whether you can put them out of business by requiring too high of a bond. So it's a balancing act that we look at, and I don't know that there's any easy solutions to it.
I guess what I'm interested in at this point are, and it can only be done with a regulatory package, because my fear is when you make that judgment call that if you do get to a point where you decide you need to withdraw, to not renew, or for failure to procure insurance, for insurance lapsing, for non-bonding, that one of the allegations in the lawsuit is going to be that that there are no regulations, there's no set procedure, that this is arbitrary and capricious, and you're singling out this particular lessee. I'm also interested, frankly, in going forward basis. I think right now the commission, from what I can see, and I'm thinking back to the last meeting where we had a lot of testimony over a lease with a fairly small operator, where I see you're somewhat in a catch-22, where you have a situation where you have a non-performance. However, should you withdraw the lease, the negative impacts of abandoning the site and the cleanup costs from the previous action are really putting you in a situation where you can't make the right decision. You make the right decision by kind of letting them go on, even though you know really, as you've looked at it, that they don't have the financial capacity to operate. And from a going forward basis, it strikes me that we can't remedy these past situations at some level, but we can develop standards so that for future leases, we can avoid future lawsuits where you and make it easier for you to make that decision, and B, that you really can have a closer scrutiny of who you are granting leases to based on long-term financial capacity to operate, so we don't get ourselves in these catch-22 situations.
It seems to me that we can do it ongoing on an annual basis, even though those pre-existing leases, though. I mean, we did item C-10 today with the marina, and part of it was that. So we can...
Yes, and in fact, one of the things we talked about, the five-year rent review and the and how important that is, I think the majority of our leases, at least in recent years, that have that five-year rent review provision also allow us to look at insurance and bonding to make sure those are up to date. So it's not just a rent review. It's looking at those additional protections for the state. But let me say, as far as bringing up the fact, trying to standardize regulations for it, it's extremely difficult because every piece of property is somewhat unique. You may have situations where neighbors have very similar situations, and in those instances, one would expect that they would be treated equally. But one marina that has 10 slips and another one that has 1,000 slips, you have to look at the economics of that and the costs and everything else associated with it and the potential liability and everything else. So it's your staff's responsibility to bring to the commission those kind of things that we believe are in the best interest of the state, and certainly it's a matter of negotiating with the property owner or the applicant, the lessee as well, as to his particular situation. And just as with the oil companies and when major oil companies started leaving California and small companies were coming in, we were extremely concerned about those companies being not only being able to perform because of lack of experience, but their assets that were available if there was a some kind of an event that would raise liability for the state. So we look very carefully at those situations when we have the opportunity to do so. But it's difficult to actually adopt a regulation that tries to categorize these thousands of different leases we have when some are very small and others are larger. So we try and look at each one individually and apply like standards to them, but those standards are one that are constantly changing in the marketplace and everywhere else. And if you adopt a regulation, it could be obsolete in what's going on in the world within months, or the location could be changed. And so we're not regulating these people. Yeah. What we're doing is negotiating with them the use of state property in a way that we believe protects the state's interest, and that's, we believe, the staff and commission's role.
I'm going to push back just a little bit. In a previous life, I was the Department of Toxics, and they have to lease hazardous waste transfer facilities, and they fit almost the same category. You have one in South Central Los Angeles, going to be very different than one in the Central Valley, versus going to be very different than one sitting on San Francisco Bay. And yet they have developed standards and procedures that if one were to attempt to create a new facility anywhere in California, there would be a process and a bonding procedure and an insurance regulatory environment that the staff can look to determine what's a proper amount. It has saved the state, I'm fair to say, hundreds of millions of dollars over the years as some of these facilities have gone out of business. And the bonding capacity in particular allowed the state to close them down when was necessary and to clean up the sites. I don't see that as all that different than a lot of your marine terminals and things where you've got fuel tanks and the like, and it makes it – you're going to have – if someone can't pay the rent, if they don't have insurance – and you can't close them down because we don't have the ability to clean them up, you're somewhat in a bind, and your legal staff is a toothless tiger. They know you can't close them down, and they're going to keep operating.
So. Well, that's a good point, because you brought up marine terminals, and I would add to that our offshore oil facilities and things like that. And fortunately, the legislature has given us the ability to regulate those functions. It's not strictly a land management aspect in leasing to them. But in those instances, the Commission has adopted regulations that do protect in those areas and set standards, and we are always looking at upgrading those standards for protection of the environment, both offshore on our oil facilities as well as the marine terminals. So while we were locked in, some of these leases we have, offshore oil leases, are from the 1940s, so you can imagine there's very little protections specifically in those lease agreements. However, when there's been assignments, we've taken the opportunity, like we did today, in the assignment between Air and Oxy, to actually upgrade our contracts with them and improve our ability to protect bonding, insurance, and other things. But we have a regulatory scheme that does deal with oil spill prevention. And so in that function, the Commission does set regulations. We have extensive regulations that do set standards for each of them because of they are consistent type of operations. But we have struggled with this for generations as to how do you try and treat everybody fairly when all their circumstances are so divergent when it comes to, you know, and when you have small leases like agricultural leases. We have so many a variety of leases. It's difficult to set a standard that works forever and is consistent with all those, because every piece of property that you're leasing is different than a facility that you're regulating. So, but we will certainly, we strive to keep consistency in that regard and to bring what we believe is, but we encourage the commissioners to ask us these questions, and we'll look at it further as to whether or not those kind of things are appropriate. For example, the criticism we took on the pipelines for saying that our regulations were obsolete as to the amount of rent we were charging for rights of way on pipelines. Well, the answer that the staff had was that those are obsolete and we haven't used them for, you know, decades. But we have alternatives, and we always look at the highest and best revenue generating for the state. And so an appraisal would be done in those instances, which would generate significantly more revenue. So those regulations do exist, but just as every appraisal for every piece of property is going to give you a different number, those situations as to the kind of facility you're leasing is going to be different. So the insurance amounts, the bonding amounts, if they're the same facility in the same location, typical location, then they would be consistent. But from one end of the state to the other and the desert to the ocean, we have a lot of variety of things, and it's difficult to categorize all of them into a single type of category. One of the things that we tell the commission and tell the public is the commission has extreme discretion in the management of its lands, that the decision makers for the state of California, the commissioners, ultimately have broad discretion in the management of its lands and the leasing of those lands. So you're not tied, if you believe, and based upon the facts before you, that we're not asking for enough insurance or anything else, that can be changed. It's not cut in a particular regulation. You may say we should have three times that much, and it's your prerogative in that regard. Your staff is who tries to bring that information to you in a detailed manner so that there will be, but you can always question it, as do the property, the people who are applying for these leases of state property.
I think what I heard was looking for uniformity and consistency, not that we don't lack the authority, but is provide for a fair and equitable that, you know, and I understand your point. Clearly, even a 10-vessel marina in Tahoe is going to be different than the one here in Sacramento. It's going to be different from the one in Newport. I get that. But I think what we're getting, what I understand from your point, at least, and I concur with that if I understood it correctly, is that it'd be fair and uniform to the degree possible. If you have, and I'm just going to make this up, if you have, you know, X company, oil company paying $30 million insurance, and you have a small mom-and-pop marina paying $3 million insurance, something's wrong. You know, but that's kind of what I'm hearing you say. Yep. So, but no, you continue to look at it, continue to look at fairness, and you know, there is broad authority, but the is not to look to exceed or to just look and try to get revenue. It's trying to be fair and uniform in as much as we can.
Yes, and I would say on our rent, for example, for the most part, when we don't do an individual appraisal, we have benchmarks for various regions, so everybody's treated similarly in those regions. When Senator Pavley carried SB 152, one of the things that the property owners who would be affected by that bill through their representative brought forth was that they wanted to make sure that that was in the bill, that we would look specifically at the values in the areas so that when you're dealing with Lake Tahoe, it's different than Huntington Harbor or the Delta. And so that's those benchmarks we have are standardized. Now, they're not put into regulations because we try and review them periodically and bring them up to date, but they do exist, and that's what we use across the board for those type of facilities.
Yeah. Curtis, one of the things I am looking for, and I'm fully sympathetic with your lack of staffing and trying to help. You know, as I've told you before, I'm looking at kind of two-prong. Number one, help any way we can to get you the staff you need to do your job. But number two, preparing the eventuality that, you know, what are we going to do if we don't, you know, if you don't get any more staff? And it strikes me on things like the insurance and the bonding. You know, show how old I am, going back to the days in a law firm where you had a tickler system. You know, where you didn't really have to think that much. I mean, we didn't even have computers. It was, you know, when a case was first filed, you put on the calendar when the 60-day response was going to be, when the interrogatories, when the deposition, and the law firm had an entire master calendar for all those things. Now, computers and software obviously make that significantly simpler, but to say that, you know, look, the insurance company doesn't want to tell us when they're sending out 30 days notice, and the lessees, they don't do it, so we're in a bind, I don't think that's really acceptable. I mean, I think going forward that to assign a staff person to get these leases into a database, to get the insurance and the bonding into a database, so that you don't have to rely on the insurance companies or the lessees to tell you that something just pops up, you know, pops up on a screen that says, you know, lease X, insurance on lease X is running in 30 days.
Commissioner, but it's not that the insurance is expiring. It's that they may have terminated it without telling
us. It's not the issue of the insurance here, Curtis. I think and I'm going to jump in here because this was something that I was concerned about and actually happy to hear in the report, is that and to hear that the comparison of 400 issues versus 4,000 issues in a database, let me just ease your mind. 4,000 entries in a database is really not that big. In fact, it's minuscule compared to what databases can handle these days. And the fact that the tickler system, which started with a master calendar that some poor person had to keep by hand, is now as easy as adding a task with a due date in things such as Microsoft Office or any other of these cloud systems. I'm happy to hear you say that our office has been one of the first to move to the cloud in our storage needs in the Lieutenant Governor's office. The idea that, you know, it's difficult to track things in a world where databases of millions, if not billions, of data points are now stored is frankly a weak argument and will continue to be a burr in my saddle should we not hear of some major improvements being made at the commission for those specific things. It was a major part of the auditor's report. It is a major concern. This is 2011. There is no reason why we shouldn't have a legitimate database system that tickles you on a lease review or insurance or bonding or anything that can be automated that will alleviate some of the concerns you have about your staff. And while I appreciate the decline in the staff and it's terrible and we should all be working to increase that, this is not a symptom specific to the Lands Commission. Everyone is doing more with less.
Absolutely.
So to continue to say it's because we don't have staff when we've seen a consistent decline over the years, and to see that we haven't taken the opportunities to find those efficiencies that a database system would give you is going to stop sounding like a reason and start sounding like an excuse, and excuses moving forward are going to be unacceptable.
I totally agree. I think that, and our responses to the BSA certainly documented all the approaches that we have taken. And in fact, earlier this year, most of those database issues were all resolved. So it's not the database that we find is the problem, unless you're talking about how to track a bond that expires. If it's not supposed to expire, but they stop making their payments on it, how are we notified of that? Or how do we know if they've canceled their insurance policy? And how does the commission keep track of those things? It's in our database that it's there, but if the company cancels it and doesn't tell us, then we don't know.
Do you have a clause in the lease that requires the lessee and the to provide you that information?
Yes, and now they're telling us that they can't comply with that because their insurance industry is no longer willing to do that. And so we're trying to figure out a new way to be able to comply with that. Do you penalize the lessee if you put the obligation on him rather than his contract?
Let me stop you for a second. The contract is between the State Lands Commission and the lessee.
Correct.
Is the lessee's response at this point in time that the insurance or the bonding is being canceled without notice?
There's a provision that says that you will provide us a certificate of your insurance that also indicates that there's a 30-day cancellation and notification clause to the commission staff that this insurance coverage is being canceled. They're telling us now that the insurance company is no longer willing to send a notice that they're canceling the insurance. And so we can put it on the lessee and say, it's your obligation to let us know that this is being canceled. But if they don't comply, whereas a company typically would comply with those kind of obligations because it's routine and they have it in their database that they're canceling and they have the addresses and everything, a lessee who may find out he's canceling may just, I forgot to let you know. And so it's a complication that because of insurance companies' unwillingness to keep in their database the kind of information that we've asked them to do to send these notices out. And again, General Services told us this is endemic now in the industry, that most companies are going in that direction, they're unwilling to send those notices, that we're going to have to scramble to figure out. Do we not only require the lessee, but what if he fails? I mean, what's the penalty for somebody who fails to comply with these things? So as Dave mentioned, that's another area we're looking at, is how to incentivize our tenants to comply with their lease provisions and, you know, make them do it. I mean, you just cancel their insurance cancel their lease because they didn't cover insurance, or do you build some other incentive in there to raise their rent? I don't.
So I'm assuming that these insurance products are regulated by the Department of Insurance.
I would expect they are.
Has anyone gone to the department and determined that these carriers shall or shall not be licensed to sell their products in California if they're not willing to provide notice to the state that they are canceling policies?
We have not done that to date, but we can certainly talk to General Services and take that recommendation in hand and contacts with the insurance industry. But it seems like it would be a simple thing for them to do, to let people know when they're canceling.
Curtis, I would make the request that you go directly to the department yourself. I mean, in order to sell insurance in California, you need to be licensed by the Department of Insurance. If these insurance companies are not willing to comply with basic notice requirements to the state, I think the insurance commission would want to know that. And maybe these companies would have their license pulled, and we would have carriers selling this type of insurance who are willing to comply with these basic notice requirements to make your job possible.
We'll take that direction and do it directly.
That's okay. Associate myself with Alan's comments there.
Thank you for that suggestion.
Any other questions or comments on item 54? Okay, I would thank you to the staff, and I would encourage Curtis in the future to keep us in your executive report before me, you know, at each meeting, keep us up to date on where we are in the action plan, in the process, and the progress that you've made.
Absolutely, and we'll try and get back to the strategic plan that we were starting earlier in the year and see if we can't get back that on track as well. On item 55, we have at least a couple of representatives from our major ports here in California. We're very happy to recommend to the commission that they adopt a resolution acknowledging the major impacts that the ports have provided to the economy of California and the quality of life, and in particular in recent years, their acknowledgement of the need to be good neighbors to their local citizens and deal with air and water quality and other impacts that trade has on California. So we have today, we'll be presenting Michelle Anderson, I believe, is going to be presenting the item 55, but we also have John Ballesteros, who's the Manager of Governmental Affairs from the Port of Oakland, and Alex Esparza, who's the Legislative Advocate on behalf of the Port of Los Angeles and Mayor Villaraigosa.
Do we need to take action to approve this? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
So moved.
Staff presentation.
Again, good morning, members of the Commission. My name is Michelle Anderson. I'm the Granted Lands Representative for the Land Management Division. Today, staff is requesting that the Commission consider the adoption of three resolutions acknowledging the 100th anniversary of statutory trust grants of state sovereign lands resulting in the development of the Port of Los Angeles, the Port of Long Beach, and the Port of Oakland and their contributions to the economic vitality of the state and the nation. In 1911, during the progressive era of the early 20th century, the state's sovereign tide and submerged lands were legislatively granted in trust to the cities of Long Beach, Los Angeles, and Oakland for the development of commercial ports. Through adoptions of city charters, portions of these sovereign lands are located within the ports of Long Beach, Los Angeles, and Oakland and are managed by their respective Board of Harbor Commissioners for the benefit of all the people of California. Today, the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles are among the top 10 in the nation by dollar value of imports and exports, while the Port of Oakland cargo volume makes it the fifth busiest container port in the nation. According to the California Marine Affairs and Navigation Conference, economic activity that depends on California ports created approximately 1.1 million jobs in California, contributed more than $40 billion to the gross state product, and had an impact on annual personal income of $432 billion. Nationwide, more than 2 million jobs are linked to California public ports, with California generating over 40% of the federal harbor maintenance tax to the United States. In addition, international trade is a major force in California's economy, currently accounting for nearly 25%. The Port of Long Beach and the Port of Los Angeles and Oakland are also ranked as some of the world's largest trade gateways. On an environmental level, these ports have made significant progress in the stewardship of their public trust grants, as evidenced through their clean air, clean water, and habitat restoration programs. These ports are significant public trust assets and are vital components of the national, state, and local economies. Therefore, staff recommends that the adoption of these three resolutions, as set forth in Item 55, acknowledging the 100th anniversary of statutory trust grants to the cities of Long Beach, Los Angeles, and Oakland, and congratulating the ports of Long Beach, Los Angeles, and Oakland on their contributions to the economic vitality of the region, state, and nation, and their recent but significant progress and efforts to lessen port-related impacts on the environment. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. Comments from the commissioners? Actually, I guess I'll start on this one. Thank the staff again for the presentation, and at least from my boss's perspective, Lieutenant Governor, we've seen in our first 10 months in office putting out a economic agenda and blueprint for the state how important the ports are on so many levels, many of which discussed here this morning, and at least from our perspective, want to congratulate the ports and happy to support this motion to for these 100th anniversary acknowledgments.
Any motion?
I'll echo those comments.
Excellent.
Associated with the comments also.
We had a motion to start with from Pedro. We have a second.
Second.
A motion and a second. We have any public comments? In this case, we'll start with Alex Sparza. Alex, thank you for sitting through the meeting to get to this point. And he was awake the entire time. I just want to point that out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Alex Esparza on behalf of Los Angeles Mayor Villaraigosa and the Port of Los Angeles here in support of Item 55. I would like to share a few statistics that staff talked about just to kind of go over and demonstrate how the port has grown and flourished. We're one of the nation's busiest seaport, which occupies 7,500 acres of land and 43 miles of waterfront. together with the Port of Long Beach, we handle more than 43% of the nation's container commerce. In addition to container cargo, the Port of Los Angeles also handles close to 1 million cruise passengers, 500,000 autos, and 1/3 of California's oil in 2010. The Port of Los Angeles continues to be the state's largest economic assets, contributing more than $52 billion in state and local tax revenues. The port also does really well as far as providing jobs for the state of California, providing over 1.1 million jobs throughout California's related to California's international trade, and adding over $58.7 billion in value as far as economic trade value to California's economy. Much of the success that we've experienced is in large part due to the partnership that the Port and the State Lands Commission has had over the last 100 years. Throughout the years, there's been some serious issues that have been tackled, and always there's been a sound resolution to a lot of those issues. Moving forward, we want to continue to build upon the partnership and addressing the challenges that may arise over the next 100 years. With that said, congratulations on this significant milestone. Thank you.
And our next speaker is, thank you, Alex. Our next speaker is John Ballesteros from the Port of Oakland. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, commissioners. Thank you. My name is John Ballesteros, and I am part of the governmental affairs team with the Port of Oakland. And on behalf of our Board of Port Commissioners and our executive director, Omar Benjamin, I'm here today to thank you for your partnership. It is through our work together that we are able to really serve that vital role of being the gateway for products in and out of California and in and out of the United States. When you look at imports, the products that come through the Port of Oakland touch every state in the union. When you look at exports, it's through our work together with the staff at the commission and with the commissioners that we are able to serve that vital role of expanding exports. If it's a product that's a manufacturing product in Southern California or agricultural products produced in the Central Valley or wine and high-tech products made here in Northern California, it's through our work that those products are able to get to their customers throughout the world, and we are able to generate and support those jobs that those exports create. So with that, we look forward to continuing our good work with you and continue our partnership to really produce those jobs for our citizens here in California throughout the world, or country.
Thank you, John. All right, formalities out of the way. We've got a motion and a second. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion is carries. Mr. Fossum.
Yes.
What is the next order of business?
The next is the closed session.
Your microphone.
That completes our open session for today's agenda, and we should be going into closed session at this time.
Very good.
Any members of the public that wish to address the commission during the public comment period? No. All right, then we'll now adjourn and go to closed session.